Hello, and welcome to this, the first in what we hope will be a series of podcasts by Gapify. Gapify is a process automation solution built for the corporate accounting world. Our bot, Alan, works autonomously within finance systems to complete over 500 manual accounting tasks. Now, in this uncertain economic climate, finance leaders are seeing increased complexity within their accounts receivable. So Gapify is proud to launch this series to share tips and best practices from various industry experts who have been involved in cash collection. Today, we have seasoned experts, Jeff Epstein and Adam Spiegel. Now, before their introductions, I'm going to introduce my co-host, moderator, and chief interrogator, Neva James.
Thank you, Daniel. Good morning, Jeff and Adam. Welcome, and thank you for being here on our first Gapify podcast. It's a pleasure to speak with you both today. A little bit about myself, my background. I have over 15 years experience in the order to cash cycle with a focus on AR, credit collections, and process change management. For me, I enjoy the order to cash cycle. It gives me the best view of a company's overall operational process from beginning to end, which is something that I enjoy learning. That's a little bit about myself. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Neva. Jeff, could we get the Reader's Digest version of your background and what you're up to these days?
Yes, well, Daniel and Neva, thank you very much for inviting me today, and thank you to Gapify. I've spent 25 years as a chief financial officer, ending my last CFO role was as the chief financial officer of Oracle, and I know Neva is an Oracle alumna, so it's great to reconnect, Neva, with you.
Thank you.
And Oracle, of course, is a very large enterprise company. I had 6,500 people in the finance organization reporting to me, including about 1,000 in credit collections. So a large global organization. And for the last 9 years, I've been an operating partner at a venture capital firm, Bessemer Venture Partners. We do all stage venture investing from early stage to large companies.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Adam, I know you've also got a fascinating background, and you're also up to a lot of very interesting things these days as well. Would you like to tell the audience a bit about yourself?
Of course. So I have a very different background from Jeff's. I am a four-time high-growth company CFO. The last two companies I scaled from very, very small, sub $20 million, to 150, the other $200 million. And while the scale was quite a bit different from Jeff's, in revenues, it was also different in terms of people. I had all of, I think, 50 direct and indirect reports in the finance org and IT and facilities. And I probably had five or six people in the collections effort at the last company I was with. Glassdoor was the last company, and took that from about $20 million to about $150 million over 3.5 years. And a company called RPX was a company before that. It was went from actually zero to about $200 million over 4 years, taking it public along the way. These days, I'm focused on helping other CFOs, and I mentor and advise CFOs and CEOs, helping them to scale their businesses and solve complex business problems.
Okay, wow, that's two incredible sets of experience. We really can't wait to hear some of your thoughts and insights to some of the questions that we're going to go through.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thank you for the invitation, and thanks to Gapify.
No worries. Good to have you. We hope to have you again in future. Now, obviously, with COVID-19, it's talk of the town, but also it's had some serious impacts across the economy, both from a working habits perspective, but also from the financial situation that many companies find themselves in. Jeff, I was wondering if you might be able to take this one first. What are the types of concerns and questions that are being raised at a board level specific to accounts receivable, cash collections?
Well, I'd say that there are three kinds of companies when we look at our portfolio and our portfolio's customers. There are companies that have been dramatically injured by the crisis, companies in the travel industry or restaurant industry or software technology companies that sell to travel and restaurant companies, where their revenues have dropped dramatically and they're in crisis mode. They're trying to figure out how to survive. At the other extreme, there's a small number of companies that actually are doing very well. If you're Netflix or Zoom, or you help people with electronic communication, your revenues may actually be up. And then there's a large number of companies that are in the middle that are doing okay, maybe not as good well as they thought, but that they've got plenty of cash. Either they're cash flow positive or they've got a lot of cash and we'll do fine. So the response of the company and the board depends on which of those three categories you're in. In all cases, to the extent you have customers and you extend credit to your customers, your customer's in one of those three categories. And so then you have to figure out what are you going to do about it. So the credit and collections process now has, normally the board, it's just routine, the board barely talks about it. And now it's probably certainly on the audit committee's top of the agenda and often on the full board's agenda. When I was at Booking.com, which is the largest hotel travel agent in the world, we would have as a regular part of the audit committee presentation a description of our credit collections. It was just a routine section. We had something, over a million hotels who owed us money. And in Europe, we would have a lot of hotels on direct debit, where we would just automatically withdraw funds from their accounts when the funds were due. In the United States, we had to send out invoices. In places, certain countries like in Latin America, people would just have standard terms of 60 days or longer. But even though it was fairly routine and times were good, we kept a good eye on it quarterly from the audit committee point of view. Now, certainly management is probably keeping an eye on it pretty frequently, and the audit committee is very concerned about the collectability of these funds, how we should perhaps change our terms, and to the extent that it is collectible, but it's going to be a lot slower, how does it affect our own cash flow?
Jeff, just very quickly, you mentioned something about direct debit in Europe. Do you see direct debit becoming more prevalent in the U.S.? It's not something that's done so much here in the U.S. as it is in that type of industry that you mentioned for hotels. But do you see that becoming something as a more opportune option globally?
It seems that it's developed in different countries based on whatever the local business practices are, and both the same way that in some countries in Europe, they really don't use very much checks on a personal basis. Everything is done through a debit card. And whereas in the United States, we have this check culture and history. So I think until COVID, it would take a long time to make these changes. I think people are finding with COVID that they really don't want to get checks in the mail and have to have people go into the office to process the checks and things like that. Maybe people are switching more actively today to electronic payments, whether it's direct debit or with some sort of approval process. But I would assume that this crisis will accelerate the trend to away from paper. I've seen, if you look at DocuSign, stock is way up because people are recently not signing paper contracts. They're signing electronic contracts. And I think electronic payments, it surprised me how long it's taken. I still don't understand why people, why companies send out checks. It just makes no sense to me.
Right.
They still do.
We do. What I've seen is the smaller companies, and most companies in the U.S. will use ACH or even wires or credit cards. But a lot of the smaller, especially software, what I've seen is they use checks still. They just operate on a check, which is, again, amazing to me as well. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Adam, it'd be great to get your thoughts. And I'm just wondering, when companies are growing and obviously they're looking at adapting their processes to not just the US market, but also international markets, what would your take be on both, in terms of the concerns at the moment, but also if you're starting to deal with different markets, how does that process look and what are the sorts of questions that you think are going to be asked at a board level?
Yeah, for sure. I think in addition to the three categories of companies that Jeff talked about, those that are potentially facing existential crises today, those that are maybe have opportunities to grow, and then those that are, you know, a little bit unknown and will muddle through. And then within each of those, you have different levels of capitalization. Some of those companies might be really well capitalized and might have time to figure things out, where others might not. I think you also have multiple phases of this crisis. And I think the first couple of weeks of the crisis were such that people aren't used to working from home. There's a crazy news cycle going on with lots of people on the TV every day. Social media is blowing up, and then throw on top of that the fact that you're working from home and you don't necessarily have systems or policies and procedures that are built to allow the whole workforce to be at home. So productivity during that period of time, that first couple of weeks, I think was probably horrendous. So that whether people are trying to pay bills or trying to collect bills, you know, it's very difficult to read in those first couple of weeks what that actually means, right? I think we're now in the second phase where the systems are now figured out, and companies that had required two signatures on their checks maybe have figured out other ways to get payments done, hopefully. Companies that don't have lockboxes and have checks going to the office probably are figuring out how to get those checks deposited or change the systems or take credit card payments. And so we're in this kind of middle phase. And while you have the companies that are obviously affected by shutting down the hospitality and travel businesses, I think the next part of this will really depend on how big a recession we wind up in and how long it takes to work through there, because the companies that might actually have been okay in their business in a non heavily affected business, those guys are now going to start seeing the impact of this recession and the fact that we have a lot of people who are going to be out of work and how that filters through the economy. So I think that's the big question. And that's why a lot of public companies now are withdrawing guidance, because they really, we're in an unknown territory and we really don't know how that's going to work its way through.
Absolutely. Agreed. I think one of the things you pointed out is the first few weeks were a struggle. I mean, you are working from home. You've never done it before. Do you have the systems? Do you have policies and procedures? You have a two-year-old behind you. You have a dog barking. I mean, there's so many things that individuals had to go through just to get settled to be able to do their jobs. And one of the challenges is policies and procedures. What do I do? Who do I go to? I can't just get up and walk next to my boss and ask a question. I now have to, you know, what I find is there's a lot more meetings and a lot less actual time done being placed on the actual work itself. Seems to be the challenge. Everybody wants to talk, everybody wants to communicate, and I'm not able to get the job done, my task, because I'm on Zoom all day long. It's been, you know, I've staff that are on Zoom, you know, double the amount of time they've ever been in a conference call, because it's a means of communication. So it's a very different dynamic right now as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, I will jump into the next question, which you both kind of touched on. In your recent communications with your various CFOs that you're dealing with, are there specific cash collections AR problems resulting because of this? And I'm going to tie this into the next question, because Jeff actually touched based on it a little bit in his first response, specifically to B2B customer companies, what we're seeing. And I think, Jeff, you did a great job of breaking it into those three categories, kind of the min, mid, and max, who's maximally being impacted by the COVID-19. Are you seeing extended payment terms on new deals that are trying to get pushed through? Are customers leveraging this COVID-19 scenario to get extended payment terms? Existing billings that are sitting on the aging, are you seeing customers requesting extended terms on that? And then actually being deferred, having the billings deferred. We've seen automotive companies who are saying, buy your car today, we'll defer your billing for 3 months. Are you seeing that being prevalent right now? And I'll start with Adam on that question.
Well, so I've spoken to a couple of my CFO friends and the people that I work with on a consulting basis, and it's really all over the board. I think that the bucket of companies that are severely impacted, the travel, hospitality folks, they're doing everything they can do today to, you know, to minimize cash and to try to, you know, live to fight another day. I think, but that's not a sector that I have a lot of expertise in. So I'll probably defer to Jeff on his bookings.com experience on that. But for kind of mainstream SaaS businesses, I think I think there's a lot of caution going on, and I think that folks that have committed to significant upfront payments in recent deals, I'm hearing that they're asking to try to restructure those a little bit. But I also hear that people are moving ahead business as usual. So I think it really varies company by company and industry by industry, and it's very situation specific.
Okay. And Jeff, do you have any input on what you're seeing from your CFOs that you're interacting, or your either CFOs or executive boards that you're interacting with?
I think there are several categories in this area as well. One category are large companies like a GE who use their procurement power as a weapon in normal times. And what these large companies are doing is they're just going to all their suppliers and saying, I don't care what our contract says, we're not going to pay you for another 30 or 60 days or whatever, but beyond what our contract says. And if you don't like it, then take your business elsewhere. So you have customers, the large, powerful customers who are just, their nature is to push as hard as they can. Then you've got companies that are in real trouble, and they're coming, they're saying, look, I want to pay you, I can't. So, help me out, let's work something out. And whether we just delay payment for some period of time, or some landlord, if people are saying, look, why don't I just not pay my rent for 3 months, but then I'll take that 3 months of rent and add it to the next 5 years of my lease, add it to the last 3 months of my lease, something like that. And I'm seeing a lot of negotiations where both sides understand they have to be accommodating, and they still want to preserve the relationship, and they still want to preserve the total dollars of payments over the lifetime of the contract. They're just delaying it. Then you've got a category of people who, as Adam said, weren't organized. They haven't been paying their bills because they couldn't figure out how to pay their bills, but they'll eventually figure it out. And then there's a category of people who are going to may go out of business. And so if you extend terms, you not only risk getting paid later, but you risk getting paid not at all. You have to determine, I think the credit part of the credit collections department is working overtime trying to figure out which of their customers are they not going to get paid for. And then if you're selling software and you have very low cost of goods sold, and you say, look, if I sell a lot of software and some people don't pay me, I can still, that's fine. But if you're selling hardware or a physical product with a 30% gross margin and you're shipping it to people and they don't pay you, you end up with very large losses. So it depends a lot on the kind of product you're selling.
Absolutely. Actually, that's very good points regarding SaaS is a little bit easier. But in addition to that, are you hearing or seeing that there's a larger bad debt reserve being placed on receivables at this point, just by virtue of what you said, those that are shipping hardware, are you seeing a bad debt expense being increased to cover that? Do you see anything regarding bad debt as part of situation?
The bad debt analysis is an essential part of the financial statements. The timing of the COVID crisis coming in mostly in late March means that when companies on a calendar year basis were doing their Q1 financials, there probably was not a lot of impact yet. So a couple of companies I'm involved in have increased their reserve, but I think now that you're seeing a lot of problems in April and beyond, I think it's going to go up quite a bit in Q2.
Right. I think that's the challenge I see, is it was the unknown, and now the known, but it's still unknown. Right? So how do you put a reserve in place where you really don't have that concrete evidence of what the unknown is, right? That would be extremely challenging.
Well, I think part of it is by aging. So if people are paying timely, then you're fine. And if people have been paying slow, you have to figure out, is it slow and they'll pay you eventually, or slow and they're never going to pay you? And that's either account by account or category by category.
Absolutely.
So would you say then, Jeff, that now is a good time to set, essentially reprioritize your accounts on that basis of both the categorization of what the business, whether the businesses are suffering, whether they're okay, or whether they're doing well, and then in terms of the phases that Adam mentioned as well that we're likely to see. So there's a short-term quick shock that we're seeing at the moment, but obviously that sharp shock is going to have a hangover period as well. So how would you approach that in terms of the categorization and then also in terms of the phases?
Well, when you say categorize, one purpose of categorizing is, to the extent you have a credit collections team sending out emails or making phone calls to your customers trying to collect the money, how they spend their time is going to be very different today than it would have been a couple of months ago, because it's absolutely important to reprioritize who are the most at-risk customers with the largest balances, where you can anticipate problems and try to figure out by communicating with your customers, understanding, are they going to pay you, or are they not going to pay you, or do they not even know?
Absolutely. It's interesting that categorization is critical right now in your receivables. It may not have been critical before, but now you have to take your aging and kind of bifurcate it into those categories that says, okay, these are my hot ones, these are okay, these are paying, we'll keep an eye on them. But you're shifting your focus, if you will, from those that would have been your bread and butter possibly are now your potential high risk ones because of the categorization they fall into.
And Adam, just we'd love to hear your thoughts as well in terms of whilst this is all going on, obviously this recategorization, you've now got processes that are inherently more fragile as a result of a new way of working for many companies. How would you try and mitigate against this reprioritization of the different accounts, but also the new working processes?
I think teams just need to be flexible. I think there's a lot of creative problem solving that goes on here in this period of time. And sorry, I was just getting a little echo there. I think teams just need to be flexible and rethink process and re-engineer process on the fly as they're moving forward, and do that in a way where controls are preserved. Because at the end of the day, certainly a public company has a whole established set of controls around collections, and we need just to be think logically and thoughtfully about how to do this in the new world where you still have the right level of control.
Quick question, Adam, do you believe that SOX controls will need to be re-evaluated because of COVID-19?
I think every company is going to look at that as their own set of controls and what their key controls are, and I would think that what's going on in COVID, I mean, there might be some low-level controls that are affected, but by and large, I don't see a wide-scale kind of reassessment of SOX controls because of this. Hopefully the controls that are put in place are appropriate for this environment as well.
Great.
And I suppose horizon scanning, looking a quarter or two ahead, I realize that this is very much a crystal ball gazing, but CFOs are going to be asked questions in the boardroom, what does this look like, a quarter ahead, two quarters ahead? What sort of answers or what scenarios would you be telling a board to plan for in this scenario, Adam?
I think it starts with business planning, and I think it's funny, I was reading, it was at Kimberly-Clark, one of the large public consumer products company was actually doing virus scenario planning and looking at all the various virus models to try to figure out what the possible, scenarios are going forward. And I think for a large multinational, it certainly is going to start there. For a smaller company, you've got to just kind of buy into some sense of uncertainty in the near in the near term, 6 to 12 months. And I think if your capitalization is thin, I think you want to make sure you have enough cash to survive and to live to play, irrespective of what might happen in your markets. And I think you want to be, and many companies already are looking at, certainly hiring freezes is the easy thing to do, and other ways to conserve cash, including a RIF and taking salary reductions. So the less well-capitalized companies are focused on that as a way to manage risk from the unknown of what happens going forward. I think it's just keeping your options open and being thoughtful about, what could happen. Because there's so much that we don't know yet at this point.
Right. Jeff, question for you. Do you think, with that being said, that companies, especially larger companies, will move more towards a work from home environment and eliminate the brick and mortars?
I'm not sure companies will go to 100% work from home. I think people are finding the complexity of working from home with your kids and pets and everything else is something right. People are going to be eager to get back to work. Because of social distancing, I'm sure the getting back to work will be coming in phases. And initially, everyone won't go back to work. You'll end up with only a third or half of the people in the office at any one point in time. And on the other hand, you'll probably have a lot less travel for quite some time. So people would have been out of the office who were traveling, and now they're not. So I think you'll have this hybrid approach for people who work in offices. We at Bessemer, we have a number of companies in our portfolio that have no offices and never had any offices. And there are examples of companies with close to 1,000 employees now globally with no offices. So there are certainly a lot of opportunity to have remote teams and to have fewer people in offices, but I would assume that most companies will still have most people in offices.
Okay, thank you.
I will throw in there, the trend in office design in the last 10 years has been to pack more and more people into smaller and smaller spaces. And I think that, we went from 200 square feet per person to sub 100 square feet per person in some cases. And certainly in the desk layout, we have rows of desks with a lot of open space after that. I think office design will probably have to be rethought as it becomes less advisable to pack people into smaller spaces. So whether that means every other person stays home every other day, or more space is taken down, or you reorg the public spaces or the group gathering spaces to just create more distance between employees, I think that's going to have to happen.
It sounds like it's almost going back to the old cubicle wells where everybody had their own cubicle, as opposed to the open space plan, floor plan, where everybody just sits right next to each other and you just turn and look and there's your partner. The cubicle world seems to work. Right? I like cubicle worlds.
Okay. Jeff, I just wanted to follow up very, very quickly. Perhaps this will be the, sort of the last question. I realize we're sort of running a bit short on time. You mentioned technologically enabled teams as part of the portfolio at Bessemer. With the new way of working and companies potentially shifting at least some of their operations full-time to a work from home and technologically enabled environment, where do you think the sort of the key opportunity areas are in accounts receivable, cash collections to automate? What would you be looking at as part of building resilience?
Well, as Neva knows, at Oracle, we had a four-part process when we thought about automation. We called it simplify, standardize, centralize, and automate. So we would take a look at any process, and we would say, for various reasons, processes developed that became complicated. Let's just start with a blank sheet of paper, say, if you were going to redesign the process today, how do you make it as simple as possible? So simplify. And then to the extent that you're doing the same process in multiple places around the organization or multiple countries or multiple departments, how do you standardize it so it's being done the same way everywhere? The way I think about this is it doesn't really matter if you're driving on the right side of the street or the left side of the street, but everyone should drive on the same side of the street. You shouldn't mix it.
No. We've got strong views on that, I'm afraid.
And then there is centralized. Oracle was very good at centralizing. So for instance, all global credit collections, Oracle was in one building in India, in Bangalore. So they had people who spoke Japanese and Spanish and Portuguese and Russian and everything else calling, making credit collections calls from India. And it worked. It was very efficient and effective. And then once you have a simple, standardized, centralized process, you want to automate it and use the best tools available. And of course, Gapify is a terrific tool to automate this. And I think in the crisis, the urgency is even greater because quite a few companies are going to freeze hiring. Many companies will actually have layoffs and furloughs and cut people. And you can't just take a department with 5 or 10 people and say everyone work twice as hard. If you know we're going to cut half the people and everyone who's left has to do twice the work, it's just not going to happen with the same tools. You have to give them automation, and with automation you can make people literally twice as productive or even more. So I think companies are going to be pressured into really understanding the toolkits that are already available, and then they're going to call up other friends at other companies and say, what are you using that's working really well? And if they've got good references, they're going to say, well, if it's working for them and I can do something twice as efficiently and effectively, this is a pretty important time to do it. And they'll adopt various technology tools like Gapify.
Do you think they'll be willing to release the cash to purchase systems for automation at this point in time? Or maybe just put it on account and stretch out the terms maybe?
Well, I think they will, as long as the company is not about to run out of cash and would go out of business. If they are under financial pressure and they're cutting headcount, they have to spend some money on software to enable their remaining employees to get their work done. So it's not an option for them. It's still lower cost for them to have software do it than people do it. So I think they're going to have it there. If they actually are in a strong financial position, then the question is, do they have a lot of people doing low-level work? And if they automated the low-level work, could they free up people's time to do more high-value-added work? So they're not necessarily going to cut people, but they're going to reallocate people's time to much higher value processes. And I think you have some of both.
Great. Adam, did you want to add at this? I know we're running out of time, so we'll wrap it up very shortly here. Did you want to add anything to that?
No. Jeff said it well. We were a Gapify customer at Glassdoor, and we went to Gapify because we had a whole bunch of people doing, you know, manual repetitive work, and we could up-level those people into more higher value added work by simply taking the repetitive stuff and adding it and giving it to the Gapify solution to software. So I think people do that. I think in the very near term, when people are talking about cutting heads, they don't really, I mean, a lot of times the heads get cut before the solution is in place. And then they realize that the remaining people can't handle the work. And then they start scrounging for tools to help it. But I think there's an opportunity for Gapify. And I think there's an opportunity to automate a lot of very manual processes in the finance team.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Adam and Jeff. Thank you very much for your insights. I realize that we've covered quite a sweeping range of all things in the world of accounts receivable, cash collections, and the world in general of finance. Neva, as well, thank you very much for the moderation and the follow-up questions. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for this, the first in a series of Gapify podcasts. If you have any burning finance questions, do please let us know. We would love to get industry experts and talk through these problems with them. So the way that you can reach out to us is either via our LinkedIn page. You can just type in Gapify in the search bar, or if you go onto gapify.com/podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I've been your host, Daniel Safko, and this is Gapify Podcast.